Welcome to the Chinwag Live podcast. Chinwag is an online community for digital professionals, and Chinwag Live is our regular event series established to cast light on trends across the digital media industry. You can find out more information about Chinwag Live on our website, live.chinwag.com. To find out about future events, speaking opportunities, or to get involved in sponsoring our events, you can email us at live@chinwag.com. This podcast was recorded at the inaugural Chinwag Live event, Wobble 2.0, on Tuesday the 6th of February 2007 in London. It features Dave Nicholson from Zopa, Matteo Bellucci of Skinkers, Ryan Carson from Carson Systems, Andrew Orlovsky of The Register, and was chaired by Mike Butcher of Vicosis. The event was sponsored by Exchange Team, a growing force in digital recruitment. You can find more details about them on their website at www.exchangeteam.com. And you spell Exchange Team, X-C-H-A-N-G-E, team. Enjoy the podcast.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mike Butcher. I'm a journalist and blogger. I work on a blog at the moment called Vicosis.com, possibly the worst named website imaginable. Sounds like a venereal disease or something, doesn't it? Vicosis.com. Is that with a Y or an I? I don't know. Anyway, we are, of course, Web 2.0 poster children. And I'll be taking Sydney, you know, I'll be autographing later things later at the back for you. Having worked on TechCrunch, my God, that was fun last year. And now we're doing something else. So Vicosis and various other things that I can dream up in my daydreams. I've done a really stupid thing and decided to write something because I'm unaccustomed to public speaking, in fact. But I thought that just before I introduce our panel, our esteemed panel, I might just put a little sort of context on all of this, and a bit of history. That's what journalists do. We are the first draft of history, and don't you fucking forget it. So one day in the spring of 2000, I was walking along a street in Soho. I happened to be editing a business magazine called New Media Age at the time, and things were going pretty damn well. Yes, I am reminiscing. I'm sorry. Walking along Berwick Street, I was accosted by a recruitment consultant who played in the internet world. I asked him how things were going, and he told me he had 15 clients who were all looking for 25 staff, and he had about a week to recruit them all. That pretty much summed things up at the time. I knew where he was coming from. New Media Rage was going well. We had our own staffing issues. We seemed to have to recruit a new junior reporter every other week, as most were being hired by PR firms, internet startups, consultancies, you name it, as fast as we could hire them. In the eyes of most of the startups of the year 2000, 3 months as a digital media journalist was enough to furnish you with a CV most MBAs would have killed for at the time. In other words, dumb hacks like me were considered good hiring fodder. Clearly, something was wrong. Terrible pause. In fact, the pace of change in the industry was so fast, I'm not reading all of it, by the way, was so fast that sane people were doing very strange things. Not only was the concept of internet time coined, where you had to start up, raise funding, launch the site, and IPO in the space of a fortnight, but, and this illustrates it well, I actually found myself at one point seriously debating with someone about whether or not we should run our watches a bit faster. And no, I wasn't doing coke at the time. There were some great stories at the time, that we've all been there, and there's some wonderful ones about things like the junior IT manager from Boo.com taking a trip on Concord to tweak a server in New York, the inflatable boardroom at Click Mango. I gather it went for quite a large sum on eBay many years later. And in fact, Click Mango, I remember once ringing up the CEO and asking him why he'd registered his direct competitor's domain name, and him asking me, how on earth do you know that? I said, well, there's this thing called, you know, you can look up domain names and who've registered. Anyway, it was great fun. It was, we later learned, the biggest bubble in history, despite the fact that serious tomes were being written about what were supposed to be called the long boom. Oh dear. I will never make radio. Bad at doing the archers will never call me. So clearly it was a bubble. Web agencies would brag about how much they were charging for just flat HTML. FreeServe, started by an enterprising Dixons manager in Birmingham, was valued during its flotation as being worth £1 billion on the basis that its million dial-up subscribers were each worth £1,000. Fantastic. But in the fact, this was not the only bubble that had fallen us in the internet industry. Having joined New Media Age as a staffer in 1996, I'd been through a few by the time 2000 came around. In fact, I remember thinking after I joined that I'd actually missed the bubble. In 1994, having read fabulous articles about things like Gopher and Veronica, surely it was all over, I thought. But it wasn't. Tracking through the late 90s were the web design bubble of people even opening shop fronts on major high streets, hoping that somebody would be dropping in for a website on their way home from Woolies. Can you imagine? There was the ISP boom, pay-as-you-go dial-up. There was FreeServe, of course. Even the BBC launched a free dial-up ISP. In fact, the number of CDs we had in the office at the time had reached a stage where we were really having to start to think of creative ways of getting rid of them, you know, frisbee off the roof of the office, you name it. But following the ISP boom, what was essentially a digital media boom, we all know about this. Suddenly there was no such thing as a directory. Yahoo was a portal. In fact, simply everyone wanted to be a portal. Although what a portal was, nobody seemed to quite know. And there was also the print media boom. Now, I have some examples here. For those of you listening on the podcast, I am now holding a large number of magazines. Here is a copy of the Industry Standard Europe. Dead. The Industry Standard Grok, son of Industry Standard. In fact, they had so much advertising, they had to stuff it into another magazine. Digital New York, ladies and gentlemen. Perfect bounds for those, the print aficionados amongst you. Digital Coast Reporter from Silicon Valley. Brill's Content, perfect bound. God, just the list just went on. New Media Age with job ads, ladies and gentlemen. 31 pages of jobs, incredible. And then suddenly it was all over. We all woke up with a dose of reality. By late 2000, even some of us, myself included, thought it was just a market correction, please God. But at this stage, I'd joined a quintessentially dot-com magazine, The Standard, as previously mentioned. And I hope to really create some amazing journalism in this space, really kind of put a magnifying glass on things. But we ran out of time and advertisers. When one of our final editions ran the cover line, "Sack me, please," we knew we were painting ourselves into a corner. So what was different then compared to now? Well, I could give you a few stuff about valuations. For instance, there were a large number of exits, as you know, the last time round in the dot-com boom. Lots of them were at very immature companies. In fact, Library House reckons that £24 million went into seed Series A investments across Europe in 2005. In 2006, the UK alone was £84 million, which is a big increase. And that's not including some of the bigger deals that went out. But there were no IPOs, no sort of public offerings on the market, and not really many as yet, certainly not at the moment. This time there's just the lack of an obvious wacky IPO market, and the NASDAQ, what's that? The NASDAQ currently is trying to buy something else which is more profitable called the London Stock Exchange. So this suggests it isn't quite a bubble. Well, what's really different? And don't worry, I'm coming to a close now. Well, I would characterize it thus. When I first got online in the mid-90s, I found a website and an email newsletter called NTK, or Need to Know. This was, and to an extent still is, a satirical take on the internet scene, run in the main by Danny O'Brien, now of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Dave Green, who's a journalist and digital media guy at Channel 4. In late 97, stupidly or not, as a raw recruit, I emailed them to ask, how do you support it? Why do you do it? I am very curious. They didn't reply, but in the next issue of NTK, under the headline Big Questions, they replied. We had this email from Mike Butcher. Here's the answer. We do it for the hell of it. We've got about 700 subscribers so far, and that's not too bad considering we haven't done much promotion yet and are currently on holiday. We haven't yet figured out any good ways of making money out of it, but at the moment that doesn't really matter. I reckon that because we don't have any charges or advertising or lame registration systems, we can take on pretty much anyone. Like Kevin Spacey says in The Usual Suspects, they realise that to be in power, you didn't need guns or money or even numbers. You just needed the will to do what the other guy wouldn't. I have to admit, at the time, I thought, what a bunch of loonies. And I forgot about them. But I was reminded of them again last year when I attended an event in Kensington Town Hall, which 800 geeks had filled. And that there was, this was what the internet economy was always about. Individuals, creative teams, getting together, creating interesting things online. So my final comment from New Media Rage before I jumped into the dot-com abyss, joined the industry standard, was about the theme of the reoccurrence of things. I tried to get across how after 5 years of writing about the internet business, even at that point, I knew there were so many exciting things to come and many of things that I would like to write about and continue to cover whatever I was doing. But at the same time, a lot of things remain the same. The headline of the column was Groundhog Day. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm privileged to introduce our panel tonight. Dave Nicholson, this is in Dave. There you are. Dave is on my far left, who is inventor and co-founder of Zopa. Matteo Bellucci, who is... I won't even try, sorry. Matteo Bellucci, who is the CEO of Skinkers. Many of you will have seen the biogs floating around, and those of you online, read the website. Ryan Carson, the man in the hat, is co-director of Carson Systems and, in fact, organised that very conference I went to last year. And to my left is Andrew Olowski, who is with The Register. So I've had my piece, and, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to hear from our panel. So I'm going to hand over now to Dave Nicholson, who is inventor and co-founder of Zopa. Dave.
Thank you, Mike. Good evening, all. I think a little naked out here without a PowerPoint presentation behind me. This is very unusual, so I'm going to try and cover my modesty with a few bullet points and a piece of paper. I wanted to start off with just introducing Zopa to people, because I suspect a lot of you won't have heard of Zopa. So a little bit about what Zopa is. Zopa is the first lending and borrowing exchange. And what that means is we take people who've got money that they want to lend and connect them up with people who want to borrow money and let the two of them make a transaction in the middle. And because we're cutting out the banks by doing that, both sides benefit. So one way of thinking about it is it's an eBay for money. That's often how we've been described. We started a couple of years ago in the UK. We've got now 125,000 members in the UK. We've had thousands and thousands of people lend money and thousands of people borrow money. We're looking to launch in the US this year, hopefully, fingers crossed, touch wood, although we said that last year as well. And we're also looking to franchise our business into at least two other countries over the next 12 months. So the model, revolutionary as it is, appears to be working, which is quite delightful because we weren't sure about it when we launched 2 years ago. The Zopa business model, which Deirdre asked me to speak a little bit about, is very simple. So basically we charge both lenders and borrowers a small fee for making the transaction. Borrowers, we charge 0.5% of the amount of money they borrow when they take the loan out. And lenders, we charge 0.5%, sort of an ongoing annual management fee. We also charge both lenders and borrowers, we offer to sell to both lenders and borrowers insurance products. So if you're a borrower as part of your loan application, we'll try and sell you an insurance to protect against you losing your job or becoming sick and not being able to repay your loan. For lenders, we're about to introduce an insurance product that means your capital is guaranteed. So if you lend out £10,000 through the Zopa platform, you're guaranteed to get £10,000 back again. The advantage for lenders is it really puts them in control of their money. So as a lender, you get to choose who you want to lend to. So you can choose to lend to very safe people at one end of the spectrum or pretty risky people at the other end of the spectrum. And you can set your rate accordingly to who you're lending to. So actually, as a return, you're getting a good return on your money, much better than you get from putting the money into a bank. why is that a sustainable business model? Why couldn't somebody else come along and copy it? In fact, why couldn't the banks come along and copy it? Well, there's a few reasons for that. We've got a fundamental advantage over the banks. So sort of short tangent into banking theory, unfortunately. I do apologize. When a bank makes a loan, it has to keep a little bit of money to one side, just in case all of the people it's lent money to run off to Brazil and don't pay their money back. That's a cost to the bank. It's called a cost of capital. We don't have that. So Zopa has a really fundamental business model advantage over every bank in the world because our lenders don't have to have that cost of capital. Now, on a typical loan from a bank, that means that our borrowing rate is about 1% less in sort of interest rate terms than any bank can offer. So we've got a really sustainable competitive advantage against every bank out there. Now, that doesn't answer the question about why somebody else couldn't come and create another Zopa. Why do I think we've got a sustainable business model against other Zopas? Well, I think there's something of a network effect going on. So when eBay launched, their recipe for success was, you know, find the people who are selling stuff and the buyers will come. So if you've got a lot of listings, then that's where the buyers are going to go and look for their stuff. Now, our version of that is, actually, if you can find the borrowers, the lenders will come. So we're trying to build up a network effect within the Zopa model where by having large numbers of borrowers on the system, actually, that's the place that lenders go to lend their money. Now, that, if we can get that working, and if we have enough people in that system, that creates quite a barrier to entry to anybody else coming in and trying to do the same thing that we've done. Against banks, again, we have a few other cost advantages. So a lot of our services, a lot of our cost is very transactional. So because we're a very lightweight startup, we don't have the 1970s banking system that Barclays does. We don't have the huge data warehouses. We don't have any of those sort of legacy systems. We can buy a lot of the services that we rely on, so a lot of the ID and the fraud checking, the credit checking. You know, we have to do all that sort of stuff that a bank does. But we do it on a very cheap basis. So we basically buy those services as we need them from credit bureaus like Equifax and Experian. And that makes it a very efficient model, makes it a very scalable model. So you know, currently, we're at very low volumes. To get to break even in the UK, we need 1-2% of the UK market share. We can do that incredibly easily. So the systems we've built, you know, relying on other people's infrastructure and other people's hardware, yeah, we can scale up to 10 times, 100 times our existing model without really batting an eyelid or having to invest large amounts of money into that business. Deirdre asked me to talk about community, which is something quite dear to my heart. So I'm sort of vaguely responsible for managing the Zopa community, if it's possible to manage a community. I'm not sure it is. The community of Zopa members is really important to us. So we've got 125,000 people out there who have decided that this Zopa thing, this crazy new scheme that involves lending money to random strangers over the internet, is something they're really interested in. And we value that hugely. So if you look at our website, as I hope some of you might have done in the past and might do after this evening, you can see on the top level navigation, we've got one of our main headers is community. So there's a lending bit, there's a borrowing bit, there's a community bit. I think that is a demonstration of how valuable that is to us. Now, within that community navigation bit, there's the blog, there's some news feeds, and there's a discussion board. Now, the discussion board is something that we talked a lot about whether or not we should put up at Zopa, because as soon as you put up a discussion board, it becomes a forum for all sorts of abuse, mainly aimed at us. So as soon as we do anything wrong, boy, do we know about it. But actually, we've kept that up there, and that was quite a tough decision at times. But that's really valuable, because what we get through that discussion board is a huge amount of feedback on what our members think about what we're doing. So we get praise when we do things right. We get abuse by the ton when we do things badly. And it's also a place where new members of Zopa can go and ask for help. So although we have a great member services team that respond to emails in seconds and wonderful FAQs, whatever, there's still times when a new member of Zopa has questions that he can't find an answer to. Now, what we found is that people will help each other out to an extraordinary degree through that discussion board. And that's a place where really there's a space where people can pass knowledge across. And the last thing that we use that discussion board for, which we've started to do more and more, is to help us with our development. So we're continually trying to create new products and add new things into the site. And what we found is, well, yeah, if we're trying to work out how to do things, there's the traditional way, which probably involves focus groups and one-way mirrors, and it's very expensive and very bad food in the evening. Or actually what we started doing is involving our community. So, for example, one thing we were looking at doing quite recently is changing some of our screens, some of the key screens for our lenders. And we've got a specification document, and we just put that spec document up on the webpage, on the discussion board. And within 20 minutes, we had 25 people commenting on it and saying, oh, I like this bit, and that bit's terrible, and for God's sake, don't do it like that. And that sort of instant feedback is hugely valuable to us as a company, as we're trying to work out how to do this really new thing that no one's actually ever done before, because we sure as hell don't know how it all works. But actually getting our community involved in that is very valuable. Another area where our members help out, our community helps out a lot, is actually in marketing. So particularly on the lending side, this is a very new concept. No one's ever done this before. So nobody knows how to market the idea of lending your money to random people on the internet. So we've got a member get member scheme that is sort of growing in usage, where we encourage people through usage of banners and buttons and HTML code to put links on their blogs, on their MySpace pages and whatever. And we pay a referral fee, a reward fee, to both the person that's doing the referring and the person that comes in. And that's a growing source of members for us. And actually what we found is that, you know, the people that get referred by their friends and family, they tend to be some of our strongest advocates. You know, there's a real, you know, once people get SOPA and really understand how it's working and understand the benefits, they're enormously powerful at selling the benefits to other people around them. So that community for SOPA is really valuable. And actually what we're starting to do is build up a level of trust within that community. So because it's financial services and financial services is about money and money's important to people, actually it's been hard. The first year was very hard to build up any adoption at all. We had to establish a level of trust. So actually here's this random company with a funny name and a funny logo offering to take my money and then give it to somebody else, and how do I trust them? Our members, as they've learned to trust SOPA and learned how to use it, they actually spread the word that this is a company that you can rely on. They're not going to lose all your money. How do we fit with Web 2.0? Well, we weren't really built to be a Web 2.0 company. So when we came up with this idea, it wasn't fitting with anybody's particular definition of Web 2.0. However, I think in some ways we are. I think there are parts of the Web 2.0 concept that fit with us. So everyone has different definitions, but Tim O'Reilly, one of his definitions, and he should know because he came up with the phrase, is it's about the internet as a platform. And I think that's very much what we are. I think SOPA is an application that could only have been built on the internet and using that internet as a platform. It's completely inconceivable to me that it could have done a SOPA without having an online version. There is no offline version of SOPA that's possible to build. And Tim O'Reilly went on to say that one of the things that businesses that succeed in this space will do is leverage network effects. And sort of as I said a few minutes ago, I think that's one of the things we are doing. So building a network of lenders and borrowers in the SOPA site. So maybe we are a little bit Web 2.0, not hugely, but a little bit. I think the community side of it is also a little bit in that space. So one of the things that we're trying to do over the next 6 months is to create communities within SOPA where people can, say, create their own community, their own group they can lend and borrow amongst that group, and also allow lenders to choose who they lend to based on things like people's location or their jobs or their university they went to. So to be able to say, I want to lend to nurses living in London, and I'll lend to nurses living in London at a lower rate than I'll lend to anybody else, because I think nurses are a good thing. So I think we're getting there with the Web 2.0 stuff. We're probably not a leading example of it, but I think there are elements of our business model that fit in with that. Lastly, very quickly, because I'm probably up to my 10 minutes, bubbles. My view, for what it's worth, we're not in a bubble. There's no way we're in a bubble. So bubbles, whether they be tulip bubbles or South Seas, you know, company bubbles or dot-com bubbles, they're always defined by the value of the price of an asset vastly outstripping the value of the asset, which was clearly the case 5 or 6 years ago. But if you look around, you know, as Mike said, there's no IPO mania, there's no day trading, there's no $100 million funding rounds for pre-revenue companies, alas. And there's none of that madness that was around 5 or 6 years ago. And actually, if you look at the businesses that are starting up, a lot of their startup costs are much lower than they were 5 or 6 years ago. So SOPA, in some ways, isn't a great example, because actually our costs were reasonably high to start up. But a lot of the guys that are starting up today, the hardware costs have fallen, the bandwidth costs have fallen, the processing costs have fallen. Look at things like Amazon Web Services. It's fantastically easy to start up a really powerful, compelling business today, much easier than it was 5 or 6 years ago. And I think we've learned. So when I see things like the TechCrunch Deadpool and people going, oh, it's a bubble, actually, no, it's not. It's just a sign of a really healthy ecosystem. That's a sign of companies starting up and failing. And most companies do fail, and hopefully SOPA won't, but most of them do. So no, I don't think we're in a bubble. I think we're only just getting started. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dave. We're going to save our Q&A till the end, but we're moving on to our next speaker swiftly, Matteo Bellucci from Skinkers. Matteo.
Thank you. I haven't prepared all the papers, so I'll be very brief because I know you guys are tired and the QA session will be good fun anyway. Just a few words about Skinkers. We are a somewhat different company because we are half a software company and half an internet company. We started 5 years ago in Web 1.5, which, you know, was a really bad time because everybody was fucked and there was no money in the economy and there was, you know, people looking just, you know, dazed and confused. The idea we had was to try to look at communication and address the issue that outside of a browser, there was only email, and we thought that was not enough. And we started working on alternative technologies that could take care of delivering information to people outside of email. Some of you may have seen some of our desktop technology. We don't push the brand, so you may not know there are Skinkers, but on the BBC, for example, their desktop tools are supplied by us, and Guardian, The Register, and Wall Street Journal, lots of our sites use our technology. That's what we started doing in 2002. We focused on demonstrating that breaking news was something that you probably want on a desktop alert rather than your email, because by definition, breaking news, if you get it 60 minutes later, is not particularly useful. So having it piled up in your mailbox when you come back from holiday, not a great thing. We did that, and then we realized that we were onto something. We actually, as the market started to pick up, we realized that there was a requirement from both users, people, and companies to look at how you push information as a general concept to make sure that there's some certain pieces of information that we all want to get at the right time. And both us and the senders don't really care which platform, which channel they use to do that. If I want to know that my shares are, I want to trigger when my shares go above a certain price I want to sell, do I care if I get an SMS or an email or a desktop alert or, whatever that may be? Not really. So we started looking at the problem more from a sort of going above the idea of email, SMS, and desktop, and just trying to understand what is the core of the problem. The problem is that there isn't really a platform in the market today that allows you to just say, I want to send this message to this group of users, and I don't really care how they get it, as long as they get it. So that's what we built, and it's a thing called, because things have to have a name, it's a live notification platform, which is a name that sort of tells you what it is. And funnily enough, today, if you want to send out breaking news to 2 million people within a few minutes, you just haven't got the technology to do it. Okay, so that's what we do. As a company, we focus on developing technical solutions based on software that allow companies to get information out. It could be your bank balance, could be your e-bill is available from BT, could be your breaking news, could be whatever is important to you, right? Football results, I don't care. But it's fundamentally stuff that you can't really send on email because email is just not the right channel. On our quest to achieve this status of leaders in push, we realized that if we wanted to push a lot of messages to a lot of people on a computer, the current infrastructure on the internet was not really cutting it, because the internet is built on an on-demand idea where you go with your browser to something. So if you want to push 2 million messages out, it just doesn't work. So we realized that the way to do that was to use a Web 2.0 thing, which is peer-to-peer. Because if you could get 2 million computers up out there on the internet, and if you can just leverage a peer-to-peer effect where you just broadcast the latest breaking news from BBC, but every computer passes it along to their peers, you overcome the bottlenecks of having 2 million people going to the BBC server every 30 seconds to check if it's breaking news. So we found a paper on Google, funnily enough, published by Microsoft Research in Cambridge, where they described how they had built in the past 4 years a peer-to-peer infrastructure to deliver live data, whether it's RSS updates or live audio, live video, it doesn't matter, just data. So the whole thing was about live. And peer-to-peer, we're probably familiar with peer-to-peer, is very sexy, but the key problem with peer-to-peer and the main effort put into peer-to-peer is in getting your porn movies off or your MP3 files or, these big things. And using an analogy is like, using lorries to move things around. And our requirement was not to get lorries. We wanted Formula One cars. We wanted, fast things. Same idea, four wheels, clutch, engine, with different purpose. And this technology was the only one we found on the market that was actually designed for speed rather than for size. And there's something about innovation that is in the theme. Microsoft spends $8 billion a year in research, which is a hell of a lot of money. And how much do you think of that gets into the market? I always think of the last scene of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they put the ark into this warehouse. It's like millions of the most valuable things in the world. They're never going to be seen. And it's exactly like that. If you go in the labs in Microsoft, they have the most amazing technology, and 99% of it will never see the light. And so what they've done is they created a department called IP Ventures that has this very hard task to try to match technology with people that can do something with it. And we were very lucky because we fit the bill. We needed that technology. They were looking to spin it out. And we did a very weird deal, which is the first that Microsoft ever did in Europe, which is called a technology for equity deal, which means that they gave us the technology. We gave them a small stake in the company, no money exchange. But now we have Microsoft as a shareholder. It's a minority shareholder, which means that we can do whatever we like. But we have a backdoor into Microsoft, which is great. We still need to be nice to them, not to piss them off, because they're big and they can go like like that. So, but it's great. So we're a company, a small company, 60 people, UK-based, but now we have this fast track from Microsoft that is helping us getting into customers and doing lots of things. So this is what we're doing, and the focus is on delivering the best technology for push. And I'll be happy to take all your questions on on the bubble stuff. Going back to your point, I think we're in a different type of bubble, but there is a bubble. You don't see IPOs because in the last few years, IPOs were not on the agenda. What was in the agenda last few years was mergers and acquisitions. And that's where you see the bubble effect, is the YouTube and all these valuations, which I think are hugely overvalued personally. But so happy to take all the questions later. Thank you.
Moving swiftly on, we have Ryan Carson, co-director of Carson Systems. Ryan.
I'm just going to sit here because I feel more comfortable that way. So my name is Ryan, and I have a small company of 5 people, and my wife is here with me, and she's the other director. And so I'm kind of the small company representative here. But I want to give a better feel quickly for you guys. Raise your hand if you're building a web app or if you own a company that has a web app. Half of you. Okay. So why are the rest of you here? I just want to get to the point, which is that I don't think that we're in any sort of bubble right now, because the reason why the previous bubble happened is because everybody had an IPO and there was so much going on in the market and the investment world that you had no control of, whereas a lot of companies today are private. I mean, Carson Systems is a small private company, and it doesn't matter what the market thinks about what we do. As long as we're profitable, I could give a rat's about what other people think about us. So what I want to share today is why I think that. And basically, we have 2 web apps. One is called DropSend, and it's for sending large files that you can't email. And the other one's called Amigo, which helps you advertise in newsletters. DropSend is small. We built it for about £30,000. Used one developer, one designer. It took us about 6 months to build. It now brings in about $140,000 a year with costs of about $30,000. So it's tremendously profitable, but on a small scale. So what I want to encourage you to think about is, well, and I was having a good chat with Dave. I mean, Zopa is a completely different model. They have to get in millions and millions of dollars of investment because the financial world requires that. You can't launch a financial web app for $30,000 and kind of wing it and sit in your office in Bath and be profitable. It just doesn't work. But if you have a good idea and you can bring it to market quickly and cheaply, then I would encourage you to do it, because there's no reason why you can't be profitable if you have a good idea. And as we all know, if you have a good developer and a good designer and a good idea, it's pretty likely that you'll be profitable. Not on a huge scale. I mean, DropSend does not bring in enough revenue to fund Carson Systems. So what we do is we run large events, and we make most of our revenue from large events. Now, we just kind of ended up doing that. You know, that Jill and I didn't sit down and plan to do large events. We just enjoyed getting people together and then realized it was profitable. So that funds our web apps. And eventually, you know, DropSend will probably bring in enough revenue that we can spin it off or sell it or something like that. But it's definitely not a bubble, because if people like us can do it, then that means people like you can do it. And mainly what I want to encourage people tonight is that, you know, don't feel pressured to go big. You know, if that's what you want, then great. And that will cost a lot of money, and there's a higher payout at the end. But if you just want to launch something small and good, you can do that. And what you'll probably need to do is fund it with a side business. So DropSend is still a side business. You know, even though it brings in 70,000 sterling a year, it's still a side business, because that's not enough to fund 5 employees. So I guess my main point is that we're fortunate to be in an era where you can have cheap software and hardware. I mean, you know, we're hosted on, you know, a LAMP platform, Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP, which is all free. You can get a developer to build something for you fairly cheap. And now, because of things like the blogosphere, you can spend relatively little on marketing. We spend very little on marketing. I think we tried an ad in Creative Review, which sucked and didn't work. But besides that, we haven't really spent much money in marketing, and we're profitable. So the point is I think we're very fortunate to be alive now and in business where we can do these kind of things on an affordable level as a small company, but also as a big company. I mean, I'm sure that Zopa, I think it's a great idea, and I imagine that in the end it will turn out to be tremendously profitable for them. The stakes are a lot higher, but they're two different businesses. So that's basically all I have to say. So thanks.
Thank you, Ryan.
And lastly, but not leastly, Andrew Olowski from The Register. Andrew, you may know Andrew's work, who is the Scrooge of Web 2.0. perhaps not. But anyway, over to Andrew.
Good evening. Hello, everyone. How nice it is to address an English audience for the first time. I've been living in San Francisco for 7 years. Every panel and meeting like this that I've addressed, I've seen the top of everyone's heads because they've got their noses down into a laptop computer. No one's paying any fucking attention at all. So that's really, really nice. I was looking for a snappy quote. Oh, first of all, does anyone not know who The Register is? Oh, that's great. Okay. In a nutshell, I'd like to, the way I think of The Register, and we've all got our own descriptions, in the words of the founder, John Lettice, if you believe all the opinions The Register espouses, you're Genghis Khan. So it's a very Catholic organization, I think. I tend to think of The Register as at one end of the spectrum of technology criticism, and Wired magazine is at the other end. And they tend to think, Wired has a front cover which they really like to use probably every other month. This is the end of everything. We tend to think we don't dislike technology, but we just think most of it isn't very good. And we spend a lot of time thinking about how things can get better. I was looking for a snappy quote to try and introduce, is this a bubble? Isn't this a bubble? And the best one was supplied probably about 9 months ago by a friend of mine who did very well out of the first internet boom, and he has about $100 million to spend, and he's putting about $1 million into new startups. And I said, why are you sitting this one out? And he said, the big returns on investment are going to come from solving the really big problems that haven't been fixed yet, and Web 2.0 doesn't solve any of them. What do I mean by this? Well, is this a bubble or not? I'll go on to that in a second. I'll describe, is this a bubble, what's going to make it burst if it is a bubble, and then kind of do some very optimistic technology scenarios, which I think once we stop thinking about the web and focusing completely on the web and think kind of more broadly about technology, there's actually quite an interesting picture out there for all of you. Excuse me, I'll just refer to my notes. I can't do the spectacular confetti thing with Mike. Is this a bubble? I'd agree with both of the Mike terrible with names, Dave, earlier in that this isn't a bubble on the scale of 5 or 6 years ago. That was the biggest loss of wealth in human history. This time round, I believe the figure is something like $500 million has been invested in web companies this time round, and people aren't losing their houses or their investments, or at least I hope they're not. There isn't the IPO market, so I think those points were really well made. So there isn't an economic bubble of any particular significance. I think there's a rhetorical bubble, though. I think we're at the kind of crest of utopian rhetoric, which we haven't really seen since artificial intelligence 30 years ago, when people confidently predicted that chess-playing computers would be here in a couple of years. 5 years down from that, we'd be enslaved to robots who would nevertheless tuck us in at bedtime. This is the real problem with the web, and I've been trying to think and write, and our readers have been helping, why this is. Let me just give you an example of there's a difference in thinking when you're inside this web kind of thinking and one when you're out it. I did a little satirical, jokey, throwaway piece about Tim O'Reilly's definition of Web 2.0 because the poor bloke had about 45 attempts to try and define it, come up with this very blobby chart full of nebulous concepts. So I suggested five and invited readers to send in their own. Now, I looked back at my computer 3 hours later. I was traveling on the East Coast. There were 600 emails, and boy, did people not like this. But within about 24 hours, there were 1,000 emails. One of them defended Web 2.0. And a lot of these came from infrastructure people. You could see this great wave of opprobrium going around the world. It started with the people who run the systems companies in the city. They don't like it for, I think, two reasons. One, it's... And web designers, please don't take this the wrong way, because it's a real skill. It's presentation layer people trying to solve infrastructure-level problems. And the internet has real big problems with spam. A utopian approach to building computer systems doesn't solve them. Tim O'Reilly had this wonderful phrase, radical trust. Now, that really got them annoyed. Anyone who has to run a firewall or a corporate system with security in mind isn't going to depend on radical trust. The other reason, I think, is that they see this kind of woolly Californian, it's very New Age rhetoric, which actually has its roots in some of the cults that started on the West Coast. They see this as this kind of woolly covering for the next wave of management consultants. Now, why does this appeal to people so much? I think it's because it is a genuinely seductive world. Things are really broken now. The media is owned by the same people who own the government. It's very hard to get a political consensus on something like even global warming. The web is seductive because it provides a kind of off-the-shelf belief system. You know, you can walk into a store and get a suit to measure. Well, look at what the internet provides for you. It provides an alternative media, the blogosphere. You never have to leave that. An alternative epistemology, an encyclopedia, Wikipedia. It's got its own alternative economics, the long tail. None of this has to add up. So I think it's very seductive, and I can see it appeals to people. People start to project their fantasies onto the web. When very realistically, the internet's a good thing. We can see what makes money now. Some of the fog's cleared. But I think once we've escaped the kind of utopian rhetoric, we will start to have much better computer systems, and there'll be much more realistic opportunities for growth in the future. Why do I think if this is a bubble, it will burst? Fundamentally, it's the same as last time. People expected us to buy dog food and have it airmailed around the country. The internet, there's a rhetorical bubble because people basically expect too much from technology. It can't solve problems that don't exist. A lot of the uses that people are expecting to generate downstream benefits from the internet aren't going to work even if you have a laptop strapped to your head the whole time. Where do I see the growth coming from? What do I see as other flaws of this? Well, let's go on to be positive, because then we can take everything up in the session afterwards. I see two really big pants. I knew that was going to happen. I see two really big waves once we've got over some of the crazy rhetoric that surrounds the web at the moment. And the web is kind of distracting us from both of these. One of these is I'm not altogether sure this is going to be a good thing, but it's going to come from RFID tags and what's called near-field economics. Now, I'm sure most of you have had experience with the Tesco's checkout thing where you spend far longer trying to wave things over a scanner. Well, the good news is you're not going to have to do that fairly soon, because you can walk out the store with your basket and your card will be automatically debited. The downside of that, as I'm sure you can begin to imagine, is that there's no human contact in this at all. The Tesco's will simply be a warehouse, and you walk in and you walk out with a basket. Pretty soulless experience. The other big change that I'd like you to think about, which will really transform, hopefully in a more positive way, is that there's a lot going on with compensation mechanisms for exchanging digital media at the moment. I was at the big music festival in Cannes. Must be about digital media now. And there's such a lot going on behind the scenes to compensate artists for what currently is called piracy, peer-to-peer file sharing. We've barely begun to think about the consequences of this, and I'm confident that this will be the biggest positive boom in our lifetimes, because you'll be able to walk in here, and on your iPod will fill up with the jukebox from the playlist. The only thing, reason we don't have this now is we don't have a flat fee, blanket license, compensation mechanism in place. As a consequence, a lot of the technology utopians have this great big beef about copyright. It must go. Artists will have to work for free because, you know, we deserve it. We geeks. This is, you know, obviously unsustainable, and it will end fairly shortly. I predict within 5 years, although France very nearly voted for it last year. From a top-down point of view, it more or less said, here's a fee on your ISP bill. You can swap as much music as you want. Go and do it. But we will see this in 5 years' time, and this is maybe one of the few technologies I write about, which is actually truly social. It gets us out talking to each other. Most technologies we use as ways of avoiding each other. So anyway, more questions about either of those points, let me know afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. This is where you get to have your say, everybody. Are you ready? Including the two young ladies scribbling at the front here. Are you journalists or MBA? Swatting, okay. PhD, maybe. Okay. Go, everybody. Where are the mics? There's a lady over here with a mic, and there's a chap over here with a mic, and go. Questions? Anybody for our panel? Does anyone want to jump in? If not, I will ask a question. And you've heard enough from me. Oh, sir, go ahead. And can you say who you are and where you're from before you ask the question so we know which side of the fence you're from?
Hi, my name's Dominic Mason. I've got background in e-learning. When you talk about bubbles, I remember trying to set up a peer-to-peer learning system between schools and local authorities who literally hated each other. Costing a government agency £18 million, etc. So we never, ever launched it. Blah, blah, blah. I just want to ask the panel if they think there's a difference between Web 2.0 on a PC, as in a static device, and mobile Web 2.0, or even if we've got to Web 1.0 on mobile.
Mobile 2.0. Do you think we can handle that, chaps? Go ahead. Anybody? Get a mic.
I would say that I think there is a big difference, and that, you know, I mean, who heard about the iPhone launch? I mean, everybody did. But the reason why is because the iPhone is the first truly sexy computer in your hand, and at least I think so. Sorry, I'm a Mac guy. But the point is that, yes, I think it's a huge deal that everything that you think about when you sit in front of your computer at home or at office will soon become a part of your life no matter where you are, and it's a massive, massive change. I know, I think it's really exciting. It'd be cool to see what happens.
I think it's actually, I think that I agree with Andrew, we're all kind of victims of our own rhetoric, and there was a good quote I read some time ago, you know, we're prisoners of our own metaphors. I think we're all, the thing with the Web 2.0 is all techie driven, it's all these techies that make up all the fuss and create all the hype, and they do not confront themselves with the market, with the reality, which is the end user, that, you know, don't give a toss whether it's a mobile, it's peer-to-peer. Do how many people here know that Skype uses peer-to-peer technology to improve call quality? Is it important? No. You make good calls on Skype? Yeah, great, cool. You know, what does it use? Who gives a toss? So with mobile, I think it's the same. It's a digital thing. You know, it's you have a digital life, and I think it's, you know, I think people look at it from just their needs. They don't look at a mobile or a PC or a Mac, or they say, I need a door into my digital space, and they don't care what it is.
I mean, I think it's all about the applications. So when I look at what you can try and do on a mobile phone, there's a very limited number of things you actually want to do on a mobile phone. So my experience of financial services industry is that for the last 5 years, they've been trying to work out how to get you to do financial services on your phone, and no one does it, because actually you don't want to apply for a mortgage when you're on the bus. It's just of no interest to anybody. So I think for the right applications, and I think of things like Google Maps, which I use on my phone all the time, I think it's a fantastic application on a phone.
You may want to lend money to the bus driver.
For a fare, maybe. But generally, I mean, there's a pretty limited set of things you want to do on a mobile device right now, and it's limited by the technology, so that set of things will increase, but right now.
Yeah, I'd agree that they're very different, and they're actually going in different directions, and that's a very good thing. As you said, you don't even want to look at eBay when you're on a tiny screen. One thing worth thinking about with mobile is that it's going to have a very different revenue model to clicks, to web advertising. The carriers kind of almost, they won't say this publicly, but they know that data isn't a money earner for them. They spent all this money on the 3G licenses. Where the carriers are going to make their money is on transactional data. Oyster cards should be in phones. I don't see why I have to carry an extra piece of plastic. That's another chip and another radio. Near-field radio chip in there. So people looking to exploit technology will have to think much more about people coming into the stores. And again, it's a positive thing. It's driving physical foot traffic.
You've got a question. Oh, sorry. Hold up your arm. Sorry, if you've got a question. Hold up your question. Helen,
Beat Marketing. I'm a mobile consultant. I just feel compelled to say something about mobile. I use eBay on my mobile all the time, and it's a brilliant application for your mobile.
Helen, you're a mobile marketer.
True enough. Except I'm not a geek, and I'm not a programmer, and I don't actually use my mobile very often. But I do use eBay on my mobile, and the reason it's pertinent is because I'm out a lot of the time, and if I'm watching an auction, I need to know about that auction at the last minute so I can put in my last minute bid.
So you use Auction Sniper or something like that?
I have to watch it if there's something that is really pertinent. I also agree with you about that mobile and digital are diverging, and it won't really change until data charges come down. But at the same time, there needs to be more cross-pollination between the mobile world and the online world for really exciting things to happen. And I'd really like to see more of that happening. Just a comment.
There's a question towards the back there, gentlemen. Could you put your hand up, please, sir? Thank you. Could you say who you are away from?
It's Julian Bond. I'm CTO of Academy. I had a question for Andrew. When you were down in Cannes, did you come across any realistic, sustainable solution for compensating artists for the content they produce, and particularly for the music they produce?
Yeah, and it's a really old one. It's the one we use for radio. It's the one we use for public performances now. You take a pot of money and you divide it up. It can be on your mobile bill. It'll be on your ISP bill, and it's as little as 50 pence a week. It's kind of absurd when people look at it and think about it and think, why have we got people being prosecuted? Why have we got these anti-copyright wars? It's so easy to fix.
But who collects the money and who distributes it?
It can be the same people who do it today, or it can be in the US, the Sound Exchange was created to do it. It's conceptually very simple, pot of money and divide it up. Practically, it's horrendous. You have to study music law for a long time. There's all these collection agencies that are lined up against each other. It's an absolute nightmare. And it's actually asking them to do a lot. It's asking them to walk over a cliff into like the digital world, and it's very hard to ask people to do that. When they realize that they're actually going to be better off than before, maybe we'll shove them along. But that's why it's taking so long, basically.
Excuse my cynicism, but I don't believe a centralized system like that will work.
What makes you say it's centralized? If it works for radio, for...
Let's take it offline. Have a fight later, chaps.
Can I make a comment on this?
Matt.
Yeah? It's an interesting point, and I think I'm seeing with digital rights that actually digital rights could be something that could bring mobile and PC and television actually much closer, because the rights holders, you know, whether it's the guys that own the rights to the FA Cup or it's music rights, they're going to have to, if at the moment they're selling the rights on different platforms, the platforms are blending now because you can be on a PDA with Wi-Fi. Does that classify as a mobile? What if I buy a mobile phone that has Wi-Fi connection and download a song over Wi-Fi as opposed to downloading over 3G? The point is, I think that the rights should be linked to the individual. If I pay £3 for a song or £1 for a song, it's my song, and it should be platform agnostic. And I've speaking to some of the rights holders, they're going in that direction because they think that it's not their job to say whether something is mobile or PC or IPTV. Is they say, I own the rights for this song, you want to buy it, you're Mr. John Doe, give me £1 and use it on any platform you like. And that's probably going to accelerate things for the merging of the platforms.
Any more questions? Let's talk about whether or not there is a kind of a new movement, whether this is new, what is happening now, or whether it's just old stuff repackaged. Go ahead.
Justin Cook, Fortune Cookie. I kind of agree with Mike about the whole Groundhog Day sort of theory. I mean, much of this stuff has kind of existed for many, many years. It's just we're sort of giving it a new spin. But I'm afraid I was going to ask my question before you sort of said, oh, ask something about new, Mike, so I'm going to kind of ask something else, if that's all right. Sorry about that. It's more about kind of brands, really. And, I mean, you guys up there on the stage, you know, you're all, and a lot of respect to you, you know, you're all relatively young, new brands. But one thing I wanted to ask you about was Web 2.0 and brands, and you know how kind of brands are kind of embracing or are scared of Web 2.0. I mean, we work with a few brands, and some of them are kind of dipping their toes in the water a little bit right now with it. And I don't want this to be kind of a buzzwordy type sort of question, but it would be really interesting to kind of get the panel's opinion on that.
When you say brands, do you mean social media, that kind of thing?
I'm talking about kind of, you know, brands that have existed for, you know, 50, 60, 100 years and how they can kind of, utilize kind of a Web 2, work with Web 2, et cetera.
I'd like to speak to that. I think that if you want to epitomize Web 2.0, I would say it's about transparency and honesty. And as a small company, I've got nothing to lose to be transparent. Who gives a crap? I can share our revenue. I can talk about what works and what doesn't, and I feel completely comfortable with doing that because we're not a public company, and I don't have investors to worry about or anything like that. And I think that's very powerful because everybody just wants to hear the truth. You know, as a consumer, I just don't want to hear any bullshit anymore. You know, from marketing people or anything like that. I just want to know the truth, what works and what doesn't. And so I think a lot of people who are building web apps and services today are just giving people what they want. No more bullshit, no more trying to sell a product that people don't actually want. It's more a matter of saying, yeah, so you want to check eBay while on your mobile? Well, we'll make that possible, you know, because it's what you want. You don't want to apply for a mortgage because no one wants to do that. We built a product because people just want to send large files. That's, you know, they just want to do it. We want to enable that. I think big brands are going to be damaged if they can't keep up with that.
Let me just call you on that, Ryan. A lot of the hype about Web 2 is people building applications which are effectively features, but they're not actually businesses. So they're kind of, you know, a nice to have, or it's something that's nice in my browser, or it tells me about, gives me an update about something. But they're not actually businesses in their own right. Or maybe they're looking for a business to buy them as a feature and incorporate them. But, I mean, what do you think?
I think it's important for people to have a business plan from the beginning. And so if you don't have a plan to be profitable, I mean, we talked about that, you know, Zopa has a plan to be profitable, Dropsend had a plan to be profitable. I think it's important. It's just bad business to launch a feature and have no idea if it's going to work financially.
Go ahead, Sir, can you say who you are?
Alan Patrick. I co-founded a consultancy, so we're one of the people feeding off the Web 2.0 thing. I've got a comment and a question. The one comment I'd make is on the last question. What we're noticing, compared to all the pitches we did a year ago about Web 2.0 to the big brands, and they told us to go away, what's happening now is a lot of the websites that do Web 2.0 stuff are beginning to overtake the traditional ones in terms of reach and all that stuff. So there's definitely been a shift in 12 months. Now, my comment was more to Andrew, which was he said the Web 2.0 doesn't solve problems, and I wasn't quite sure whether the problems it didn't solve were the sort of existential why are we here, or whether they're more specific, you know, what is Web 3 or whatever it is going to do. I just wondered if you wanted to expand on that a bit, so I could
I think
write
it's the
it down and consult on it. You know,
free
advice.
People just expect too much from technology. I think the internet has real problems with it, with spam. Any open system gets prone to entropy, and the Web 2.0 people are very slowly discovering that. We can talk about trust or demanding transparency, but there's a much bigger problem, which is that are the people who are commenting on your site representative of your true audience? Because, or your true market or your true customers? A lot of the time they're not, because the people who are using the internet at the moment are a very small, unrepresentative subsection of the population. And marketers have already kind of looked at the blogosphere and gone, right, okay, this is like supremely, almost telepathic focus group we've got out there for free, and they've launched something, and it's a disaster, because they've forgotten that this is a really small, self-selecting, white group of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the issues we've had with Zopa. So, just talking about the discussion board earlier, one of the things we always have to keep in the back of our mind is, actually, those are the real hardcore nutters, and they represent a very small percentage of our user base. So one of the things that myself and Justin, who's our UI designer here, we always end up rowing about is, you know, how much should we design for the hardcore and how much to design for the mass? And you have to balance the two very carefully. It's difficult.
Gentlemen at the back.
Hi there. Charles Astwood, founder of London Eaton. I just wanted to ask the panel, basically, what you felt is more important. Existing revenue streams on sites or the potential of users from sites. Obviously, you've got the 2.0... thing with people putting a lot of emphasis, as they probably did in the kind of bust times of 2000 on many, many users using it, but no existing revenue streams, and whether that was more important at the moment than actual businesses earning money as when it comes to terms to selling.
A real dot-com question. Is there any money in any of this?
I'll try to give my view. There are two very different business models, and I think the good thing about the post-bubble is that people have learned a few things. One is that you should look at the cash first. So revenue is king, always, and much more than used to be. Having said that, there are some good examples where no revenue, lots of users have been gobbled up by somebody who paid a lot of money for it. But that's, I think, is more the exception to the rule. So if you're building a business today, you should just focus on the revenue. And if you end up having a very large user base, and the opportunity comes around, great, but it's very hard to build a business model around that, I think, because it's extremely risky. Unless you create something that doesn't cost you anything to do, you just get it out there, it costs you £30,000, you set it up, and by miracle it flies, great. But to invest on getting people to join a proposition, I think, is you even need the money, but then it just doesn't work out anymore.
I just wanted to go back to the point about the brands. I think it's very interesting that the three businesses and the register, even if they won't admit it, are honest and measurable. And I think the message that the brands are getting from a lot of their traditional agencies is, yeah, stick with posters. Posters are great. Posters are brilliant because the agency can get $2.7 million for going to South Africa, taking a photo of a car, sticking on a poster. Is it successful? Who knows? I'm just interested to see if there's any sort of... whether you've been at loggerheads with traditional agencies and what's your experience there, especially the skinkers.
Yeah, okay. Direct question. If I can use an analogy, I think if the internet was a person, I think is like a 13-year-old teenage who thinks he's worked everything out about the universe and their future life, but they haven't got a clue yet. And I think that's where we're at right now. We're still, you know, there's a lot of companies that think they've got it all worked out and they can spend $2.5 billion to buy somebody because it's going to be worth that. I think we're still very early in the internet. which means that from a big brand point of view, it would be very silly to throw away 70 years of proven marketing for the new kid on the block. What's happened is that they are warming up to it. They are doing it their own way, which is putting money into it slowly but surely. You know, we're reading how much, you know, the budget, yearly budget of the P&G and Coca-Cola of this world is going into digital. So you can't negate that they are doing it. But they're doing it in a very pragmatical way. And, you know, maybe posters, the cost of posters will go down, but I think they're still cool and, you know, they still do the job. And I think they will be doing that for a long time. So I think it's just happening very slowly. It's going to be a natural transition. So there's no earthquake around the corner, I think.
Questions, anybody? Keep them coming. Put your hand in the air. We'll have one just... But there's the, I know, here the managing director of Chinwag, sorry, I'm going to ignore him. We'll have him first, and then we'll go for Sam.
Is this on? Hi, my name's Andy Martin. I'm a freelancer. I guess the question I had is about the startups you're seeing, and I followed sort of Brian's blog, all the various blogs you've been doing about NewSender, and that's been really interesting. I guess the question I have across the group is, to what extent do you see these startups actually addressing market needs? Because if I think about Zopa, which I think is a fascinating business, you're launching in the consumer credit market, which is just like the world's most cutthroat market. Great for being a fascinating platform, but it's a nasty market. You're going into eBay was like, there's nowhere to sell your crap. Mm. Whereas, you know, there are plenty of places to get personal loans. So it's almost, how does that thinking build into this sort of startups you're seeing? So I guess that's a specific question for Zopa, but then a general question for the other guys.
Shall I go first? I think it's an interesting point. I mean, the UK unsecured lending market is really competitive. Now, that's great if you're sort of a classic good quality credit risk. What Zopa was set up to try and do was not just cater for those people who you can get a loan from any bank or any online lending facility. What we wanted to set up to do was to try and create a more human way of credit assessing people, so to be able to take into account things that most banks don't. So, you know, as a freelancer yourself, you're probably aware that it's probably quite hard for you to take an unsecured loan, or certainly the banks will look at you differently from if you'd been working for British Telecom for 10 years. And what we wanted to do, one of the reasons for setting up Zopa was to address the needs of that new group of consumers, because we think there's a growing number of people out there that actually the banks and the credit scoring, you know, companies just don't address very well. So yes, on one hand, you could say there's an existing market that's very competitive, and that's true, but also we think there's a gap in the market there for people that they just don't reach right now.
Does anyone else want to have a go at that?
Quick comment. I think that consumer propositions, what the internet, I mean, if you believe in the long tail, I think it's, I believe parts of the long tail idea, the long tail has created a new opportunity. So, like if you read the article on the long tail, the description says there's a tidal thing has gone out and now you have all this new land there. There's definitely a new market that has been created by the internet, and there are consumer propositions for that market, which are the Zopa, the eBay. There are consumer positions on the traditional market. In terms of all the startups, what they're focusing on, I think that unfortunately, and that's where there is a bit of a bubble, there's few consumer propositions of value in the traditional space. Most of the things are kind of self-fulfilling prophecies of, you know, solving problems that are not there, as Andrew was saying, I think. I see more interesting things happening in the new space, sort of on the long tail, because it's a bit more land grabbing going on there at the moment.
Yeah, one just very quick example of something that's an innovation. It's not really web related, but once you hear of it, it's like, "Dole, why didn't anyone do this before?" Which is Orb and Sling Media. You're at somebody's house, you're in a pub. Can you show them your photographs that you've got on your home PC, on your phone? You can't until now. Can you access your playlists on your home PC at work or on your phone when you're on the bus? You can't, but you can until now. X Series 3 has just launched a plan where you can do that for £10 a month. I didn't see anybody kind of predicting this, but once it's there, it's such an obvious thing to do. So when we get down to basics and look at what people really want, there's lots of space for doing that.
Just to speak to that question myself also, certainly at Vicosys.com, when we're seeing some of the startups who send us pitches about, you know, write about us, tell us, you know, review our site, tell us what you think, etc. There's one thing that I think is an interesting thing is that the sort of the engine of social media is starting to run dry just a little bit, especially when I see another startup telling me that people can socially network around place, and when they're going on their gap year and have a kind of a MySpace style page, and with a blog and upload videos and stuff like that. That engine is running down, and it might have a very nice Ajax interface, as Andrew was saying. Interface does look lovely, and you know all these new permutations of design online do look great, and they do look completely different, actually, and often than the old-fashioned Web 1.0 world. But what's underneath, and I think that's where we've got to get to. So we'll get some more questions. I'm going to go throw to Sam here first. You had a question, right? And then there's a gentleman there, and then any other questions that I can look for? Keep going, Sam, and I put your hand up, and I'll come to you in a minute. Go ahead, Sam.
Sam Michel from Chinwag. Excuse the croaky voice. That's why I'm not chairing tonight, and Mike's doing a fantastic job. I suppose my question, I wanted to be the voice of doom. And just I hear Web 2.0 used as buzzword bingo by digital media agencies to potentially pitch their clients and befuddle them with weird community things and why they should build their version of MySpace for their favorite washing powder or equivalent. Is there anything new, or is it just the same old things that, as Andrew points out, are not even solving technological problems? Or is there something fundamentally different about what we... I still clench slightly using the term of Web 2.0, but all the things that we put under the Web 2.0 banner?
The main thing that we need to remember is that everybody that's building these kind of applications are businesses, and they have to be financially viable. And I can't remember who said it. Yeah, you can build something and hope it works if it costs you nothing. Great. But because everything needs to be profitable, I would say that it's all about cash and revenue. And you have to, whenever, and this kind of speaks to your question, if you have an idea, you have to open Excel and do a cash flow model and see if you're going to be profitable. And don't even think about spending any money until you know that at least it's likely to happen. And I think there's a lot of mistakes being made right now where there's a lot of VC money going around, and there's probably investors in this room, and a lot of it's being wasted because even to spend $1 million on an application means that you have to be able to get $1 million out. And if you look at Excel and you plan your revenue model and you look at it, you know, like I said, DropSend brings in about $140,000 a year. We're at the moment trying to sell it for $1 million. And we don't have any buyers yet. Well, why is that? If there's money being spent by VCs in the $5 million to $10 million range, and we have actual revenue, what's wrong? And I would say that you've got to open Excel and make sure it'll be profitable, and then you're cool. And if you're not, take a step back.
Okay, we're in the final questions round here now. So there was a gentleman there who's held his hand up for quite a long time, just there, that way. And then go. Say who you are, where you're from.
Yeah, hi, Stefan Schulter, pad.com. I mean, Mike, with all due respect, but the people who were hyping Ajax and the rounded corner sites and all that stuff, it was guys like TechCrunch, as far as I remember. You
absolutely, and I hate them.
Also, for the gentleman with the hat,
those bastards.
I'm terrible at name as well, but you said with the blogosphere, we have this whole market, you know, ready for us to contact and so on. But from what I've seen with TheraPad is it's always the same 65,000 people, the same early adopters. The mainstream, it's still very hard for me as a company that does blogging and all that sort of stuff to actually reach them, unless I have millions of dollars in venture capital, which I don't. So. Yeah, I mean, that's all I wanted to say.
Just bitterness.
Yeah, bitterness.
That's good. Right. Bitterness is good. Let's all have a bitch session. Okay. Now, go ahead, sir. I think this is going to be almost the final question, unless anybody else wants to pitch in. So you go ahead, sir, and I assume that there aren't going to be any further questions.
Okay. Thanks. Steve Clayton from Microsoft. It was good to hear the skinker story, sir.
Oh, the man from Microsoft.
Well, I like the Raiders of the Lost Ark thing.
This is a lovely end.
It's a picturesque end, isn't it?
But how about Vista?
It's a beautiful operating system. How about, I'm delighted to see that Ryan's a Mac guy still uses Excel on the Mac, though. That's good to hear. So, in the kind of the fuel in many ways for Web 2.0 appears to be the advertising business model. And you, a few of you have talked about community, and it seems that a lot of people are just interested in build a community, get people to come, and then sell some ads, and that's the business model. And it's quite refreshing to hear that, you know, a couple of the guys here on the panel, that isn't your business model. But I guess I'm interested, certainly from your point of view, Andrew, from the West Coast, how sustainable is that as a business model over the long term, or is that something that we should even care about?
I think we need an Excel sheet here to do some calculations.
Well, I gather that for every, I don't know if this is directly relevant, for every pound that's been spent on print, only one third goes back into online advertising. Many of you will probably have better statistics than that, but online businesses will be much smaller. We're very fortunate. I mean, we've got 35 staff now, but we had eyeballs very early on. We didn't take VC money, and we were kind of living on our means well before the bubble burst last time. I'm very pessimistic about a lot of these opportunities. That's why I think transaction-based business models will be ones where it's real money. It's you know, there's no intermediary. There's no, it's just money.
I think that it is sustainable, definitely, because, I mean, Microsoft wouldn't be launching Ad Center if you guys didn't think so, and also Yahoo wouldn't be launching Panama. The ability to accurately track whether or not your ads are working is amazing, and as a small company, we use AdWords because of that fact, and, you know, we'll probably try Ad Center and Panama. The ability to advertise and know whether or not it's working is amazing. You know, like I said, we put an ad in Creative Review. I don't know if it worked. I don't think it worked because it was a print ad, and, you know, and so yeah, I think it's very sustainable, and hopefully it'll continue.
Well, nobody's mentioned click fraud, and I gather there's somebody from Yahoo here. The problem with both Google and Yahoo is, and they both share this problem, they run closed auction systems. To me, that's something that Wall Street quite rationally finds isn't very comfortable with. Wall Street and the financial markets are all about kind of risk management. When you've got companies that basically are set the terms of the entire auction, basically control this entire, you know, market that guys like you depend on, I'd get nervous.
I think just one last comment on that. I think there is one underlying variable that never changes, which is the amount of time we'll have. And that's not going to change soon. And then I think people will go where the eyeballs are, because if you need to get people's attention, you're going to have to go where the people are. So people are definitely going into the digital channel, so the advertiser will chase them. And whether people will be able to create models like the standard television model, where you get free service, basically all advertising funded, Channel 4 and ITV, there will be examples of that. I'm not sure if that's going to be the norm, though.
Right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to wrap it now. I'm off to have Ajax inserted digitally into my DNA, but... So I have an appointment now, which I have to rush off to. So we're going to wrap it up, and I'm going to say thank you to our panel, who was Dave Nicholson, inventor and co-founder of Zopa, Matteo Bellucci, who is CEO of Skinkers, Ryan Carson, co-director of Carson Systems, Andrew Olowski from theregister.com, .co.uk, the media site, and my name is Mike Butcher from vcosis.com, and mbytes.com is my personal blog, but I don't update it that much, you know. What can I say? Google AdSense is just shit, isn't it? And lastly, I just want to say thank you very much for indulging me earlier with my speech. I will never, ever reminisce again about the dot-com bubble, and that's a promise. No, actually, I'm lying. Thank you very much, everybody. Please enjoy the drinks and chat. Goodbye.
This podcast was recorded in front of a live audience. To find out about future Chinwag Live events, why not subscribe to our free newsletter at live.chinwag.com. Chinwag Live Wobble 2.0 featured Dave Nicholson, Ryan Carson, Matteo Bellucci, Andrew Olofsky, and Mike Butcher. Audience microphones were wrangled by Kim Ng and Patrick Kamara-Ropita. Door enforcement was provided by Thayer Driver Security of Dartford. Sponsorship was handled by Hugh Evans and Thayer Driver. The commissioning editor was Sam Michel. Chinwag Live was produced by Deirdre Malloy.